Welcome back to the NBA show here on the Mojo Sports Network. I'm your host, Alexander Jay. It's silly season. Most teams, 3 or 4 games left. We got 1 week left until the in-season tournament and then the NBA playoffs, the best time of the year. Joining me today, Yuri Bilcic and Tom Dev. How have you been, Tom?
No, I've been good. To be honest with you, as a Celtics fan, it's just been great sort of sitting back and watching all the carnages, all the other teams work out exactly what their seeding's going to be. Meanwhile, I've known for about a month, so it's been great. It's relaxing for once, which is a rare thing to say as a Celtics fan.
Some of those, that carnage involves late season injuries, including to Yuri Bilcic's Milwaukee Bucks today. Yuri, we'll touch on the injury in a second. How are you? How's your week been?
Yeah, great, Alex, and thank you for having me back on for another show. And yeah, unfortunately, I did watch that game today, probably from late in the first half onwards, and it just looked extremely innocuous when Giannis went down, and sort of fingers crossed that it's nothing too serious on that end. But yeah, just sort of been trying to get my head around in terms of the snakes and ladders with the seedings and sort of the play-in, well, not the play-in implications, but just more the fact with the season series tiebreakers, which could well have an impact, like Golden State beating the Lakers today. So
absolutely,
they hold the tiebreaker in that, having won 3 or 4. So there's so much to sort of process in that regard, and that's going to play a significant part. We saw today with the Suns losing to the Clippers and the Pelicans being the trailblazers, the Pelicans go ahead by a game, even though the Suns hold the tiebreaker. So yep, there's so many machinations, right, just in these final 3 games that are going to really determine and where teams finish from 3rd to 6th.
Well, on today's show, we're going to talk about the news of the week. It is silly season, so we'll look at a couple highlights of the last week or so. We're going to peer into the first round, some potential matchups and some problems that might arise. And then we're going to recap what our NBA awards were. And if we can go back, we'll try and remember what we did 30-odd weeks ago the season started. But it is the 51st episode. And before we get started of the NBA show, you might remember the last couple of weeks we've been tracking the rankings on the podcast basketball charts. We got up as high as 41 last week, and we've been asking for your 5-star reviews. You know, a 4-star review would probably go a long way. We've fallen down to 94. So if you want to keep us in the top 100 for Tom and Yuri's sake, consider heading over and leaving a 5-star review currently. All right, Tom, news of the week. There's a lot to choose from. I think something... There's a James in your last name for your news of the week, but it's not LeBron James.
No, it's not. I had to talk a little bit about Bronny James declaring for the draft, which is rare. You know, it's rare someone declares for the draft who isn't in the top 60 players and you talk about them. But when it's the son of the second greatest player of all time, you kind of have to talk about it. And the fact that there's some implications with it, because the theory is LeBron will go and join him. Maybe not straight away, but you kind of think at some stage. I mean, LeBron has reportedly said he's only got 1 to 2 years left in the tank. But, you know, LeBron also said he was retiring, 2 years ago? So you never really know with him. But look, Bronny James has declared for the draft, but he's also put his name in the transfer portal for colleges, which I'm not 100% sure how that works. But all I know is once you declare for the draft, if you don't pull out by a certain date, you cannot declare again. So if he doesn't pull out, this is it. This is one shot of being drafted. And, you know, I mean, Bill Simmons and Ryan Russillo had a long chat about it on the Bill Simmons podcast the other day. And they're pretty convinced that a team will take a shot at taking him, which I don't see why not. I mean, you know, you look at the end of the bench guys, how often do most of them play? Like, it's rare. I mean, the Heat literally made 2 final series with Udonis Haslem just sitting at the end of their bench. Like, does the 13th man really matter? So if you can draft a guy with a late second round pick and also potentially add LeBron James, I think that's a win. They talked a lot about Philly being the potential team since they'll have like a late second round pick and they'll have cap space to go and get LeBron. I don't mind that. But personally, I think you just draft him if you have the chance and see what happens.
Yeah, ESPN reporting a couple of days ago that LeBron James is expected to opt out and then seek a no-trade clause in the next contract with the Lakers. That can just be leverage play. Maybe there's a no-trade clause in the second year, but if you get traded mid-year to the team your son's on, then you're stuck with them for another 18 months. Yuri, I'd love your thoughts on this one if you've got any.
Well, there was actually a sort of a trade discussion perhaps during the offseason, which centralizes around Donovan Mitchell going to the Lakers. And if the Cavaliers draft LeBron's son, Bronny, and LeBron as part of that package, both go back to Cleveland. That's just something that was brought up, I think, Mate, 24 hours ago, sort of stumbled across on the Facebook post. So that'd be sort of one intriguing to see because it's sort of been circulating around about whether Donovan Mitchell will put pen to paper to extend his time in Cleveland or not. So it's sort of really interesting waters in that aspect too, and what happens during the offseason there. But even LeBron's mentioned so many times about wanting to play with his son before his career eventually he rides off into the sunset. So we'll see what happens in that aspect.
All right, sticking with you, Yuri, your news of the week is what?
So we've got two NBA legends, veterans who did so much in the league for over a long period of time, including Vince Carter, played in three separate decades, the 90s, 2000s, and the 2010s, and of course, 2020. So four, should
Four,
I say.
yeah. I think his
Him?
last game was when the season got shut down for COVID, right?
It
In March.
was.
Yeah.
It
Okay.
was. Yep. So him and Chauncey Billups will be inducted into the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame this year. And it's absolutely worthy recognition for both players. You think of Chauncey Billups taking pick three in 1997 at the University of Colorado, drafted by the Boston Celtics. His career gets off to a bit of a journeyman start, if you want to use that term as well. He didn't quite get along with Rick Pitino and sort of got bounced around, traded to Minnesota, played there for a couple of seasons with Kevin Garnett, and then really found a home in Detroit, right, where the Pistons were, of course, really elevating themselves back up into being the Eastern Conference champion, which they eventually did in 2004. And he was a big part of that too. And he got that nickname, Mr. Big Shot, hit big time clutch shots when the team needed it. And he formed a really good pairing with Richard Hamilton, Rip Hamilton, Rasheed Wallace, Ben Wallace, Tayshaun Prince. And they were by far the most meanest defense that the league's ever seen, probably in the entirety of its history, shall I say. So now he was absolutely a big part of that too. And even Denver, he provided really good production there as well. And he just had this real calmness about him too, Alex, that you see with elite point guards that they rarely get rattled when the pressure really arises to the top. And he was one guy that you could really depend upon to hit those big shots as well and really facilitate for his teammates. And he had really good court vision as well. I think that was a big thing with Chauncey too, that he could just operate on another level, which made him that more extra dynamic. And as for Vince Carter too, pick five back in 1998, played three seasons at North Carolina, was a teammate of Antoine Jameson's as well. They reached the final four, I'm pretty sure, back in 1997, 98 as well. Unfortunately, they lost to Utah, led by Andre Miller at that time. I think Michael Dolyak was on that Utah team as well, and it was pretty bitter at that time for Vince because him and his mum came to agreement that he would play out his entire 4 years at North Carolina. And then because he had to sign a contract saying that he'd complete his whole college education, which he eventually did, I think back in 2001 when he got his degree prior to that game seven, the Eastern Conference semifinals against the Philadelphia 76ers. But people knew right away, Alex, and you've seen tons of Vince Carter highlights, that he was just so elite at what he did, right? Teams would have to sort of scheme different strategies to stop his baseline drives. And it was something that even Knicks coach Jeff Van Gundy talked about numerous times every time New York played Toronto, was how do we cut out Vince's baseline drives? How do we sort of trap him from the top and force it out of his hands? And we saw that in the 2000 playoff series where I think Vince only shot 30% from the field and he only averaged 15 points. And Latrell Sprewell was the main assignment man for guarding Vince in that series, and Patrick Ewing, I think, really played more as that double team man as well when New York decided to draw up those plays. But we saw in 2001, right, he copped criticism from Charles Oakley. I think it was prior to game four as well. And of course, Vince's mum, Michelle, took exception to that as well. And I think it was during game four, early in the last quarter, Dee Lynam was interviewing her about Vince's performance. And I think Michelle cryptically mentioned about a
How did
particular
you remember
teammate.
the reporter's name from 2001? Can we just put a pin in
Yeah,
it there?
so
Like, if the
so
listeners are
D
always really
yep.
familiar with Yuri Bilsich, the mini basketball encyclopedia, we need to upgrade that to the full basketball encyclopedia. How did you remember the reporter's name from 2001?
So Alex, watched a ton of sort of old Raptors Knicks games back then as well. And Dee Lynam was always the sideline reporter, and she's a very good reporter as well, excellent at her job. And she was always paired up with Dick Stockton and Hubie Brown, and the trio had just an excellent rapport of chemistry between the three of them. And her name just kept popping up every now and then as well. She covered, I'm pretty sure, the Raptors 76ers series too. And even that, I think it was game six, I think by memory, or game five, one of those games as well, where she interviewed AI after, yeah, one of the contests. And that's sort of where it popped up. And yeah, just going back to our 2001 playoffs as well, Alex, that was the Raptors' first playoff series victory too. And of course, it was Charles Oakley who she didn't want to mention, but Vince had a really good game for as well. He had that massive dunk early in the game, which, yeah, I think really sort of set the precedent for Toronto really controlling the tempo. And then from game five as well, he was just superb right throughout. Him and Spree all sort of had that shootout as well. Spree really tried to carry the Knicks as well. But Vince had that big offensive rebound in the final minute and a half where he basically followed up his own miss and put it back in, and which ultimately broke the camel's back of the New York Knicks. And I think finished with 27 points in that game. And of course, we saw that elite Eastern Conference semifinals matchup with him and Iverson, where Iverson scored 52 points in game five. Vince scored 50 in game three and hit, I think it was his first eight threes or something from downtown. AI scored 54 points in game two. It's just one of the most memorable playoff series and one of the most memorable matchups I can remember in the NBA, where two guys, two youngsters at that time, Vince was only 24, AI was only 25, turning 26 that year, where they just went blow for blow. And it was just an absolute spectacle of watching. And of course, unfortunately, that following year with Vince, he sort of had that jumper's knee, Alex, which restricted him to 60 games. And the Raptors sort of really hit a skid at 1.2. I think they lost about 17 of 18. They were third in the East, I think, early March. And they just scraped into the playoffs. They won 12 of their last 14 games. And that was all in the back of Antonio Davis's, yeah, incredible production as
I'm calling your production incredible right now. I'm calling your recollection incredible.
Yeah.
As a Raptors man also, with a hat on, this is ridiculous.
And just one more thing too, Alex, as well. We saw right when he left that it sort of ended on pretty sour terms too. And when he came back with the Raptors, I think it was the 2014-15 season with the Grizzlies, and Toronto did a tribute video for him. And you could just see how much he was sort of welling up in emotion, and you could just see the tears sort of streaming down his face. And that's how much it meant to him, the city of Toronto, because he basically put the Raptors on the border, right?
He did. No, he put them on the map. Undisputable. Absolutely, yep. Undisputable. That's Hall of Fame worthy in that point by itself. Like, nevertheless, the dunks he did in the Olympics, nevertheless, the impact he had on the floor, on television ratings, all that stuff, putting Toronto on the map, Canadian basketball on the map. There's been a big ground support for him to get him into the Hall of Fame. So, well done, Vince. From one legend to another, my news story of the week, I wanted to highlight the Dallas Mavericks. They're getting pretty bloody scary. 9-1 in the last 10 games. They're currently sitting in fifth right behind the Clippers. So that's the first round matchup we're staring at. Then if they win that, they're going to play third place. And then it looks like the Pels are going to be in sixth place. So it's at the moment, it's OKC and the Pels, but that could change. Luka legend, obviously a budding MVP case by himself. Kyrie Irving over the last 10 games, 26 points per game. He shot over 50% in most of these games I'm looking at. He had one bad shooting night against Golden State, but he's been super impactful. Those two look like they're clicking on all cylinders. This has been my team for the last 2 weeks, even almost since the trade deadline, since they went and got those forwards at the deadline. This has been one of the teams I've just been watching because they're very, very fun to watch. Tom, you would know as a Celtics fan, Kyrie Irving can be not so fun to watch. He can be not so fun to talk about. He's chosen to play every game this season. Well, not every game, but he's chosen to play most games this season. No touch wood, no scandals, no nothing. He's not refusing vaccines. He's not talking bad about the Jews. Thank God. Like, it's in the news. He's not taking the low road. Kyrie Irving having one hell of a season, which means the Dallas Mavericks are just starting to fire on all cylinders. Tom, have you been watching the Mavs? They're really fun.
I've been watching bits and pieces of them. And, you know, I kind of was close to just saying I'm giving up on watching them because there was that stretch where they lost like 20 games or something.
Yeah, they went on.
I can't remember, but it was on a poor stretch where it was like they'd win four in a row, then they'd lose four in a row, then they'd win four in a row. And it was just a mess. And it was a lot of just Luka scores 40 and then they still lose by 10. But lately they've been great. And Kyrie Irving, credit to him, has, you know, you normally say has, you know, pulled their head out of the sand. I think he's actually put his head in the sand. He's sort of disappeared off the map, except for when he's playing, which is fantastic. It's what you want from him. Although we do need to just sort of pause on the talks of everyone going, he's one of the most skilled, you know, best point guards ever conversation. Like, no, he's not. He's been a, you know, second player, second star on a team his whole entire career. And the one time he was the 1A player, didn't go so well. But no, look, I've got it highlighted a little bit later down when we sort of talk about the first round matchups. But that Mavs Clippers one, that's tasty. That is very tasty.
Mm-hmm. Fifth in the league in points scored, sixth in pace. They play pretty quick. Ninth in offensive rating. That defensive rating starting to improve at the back end of the season as well. Yuri, any thoughts on the Mavericks quickly?
I think, as you mentioned there too, Alex, about their tempo of pace, and that's significantly changed as the season's sort of worn on too, and I think in a much better way too for the Mavericks as well. I think that's what Jay Kidd, of course, during his playing days, always played with up-tempo style and looked to push the floor at all costs, and that's what the Mavs have been doing. I think with the whole sort of floor spacing too, as well as Luka, where teams have sort of gone to double-team him and his whole vision, right, he's sort of, I think, there was a game against Houston most recently as well, and Ime Udoka mentioned too how they sort of just went to guarding him one-on-one and didn't really want to send a second man to trap Luka because his passing from different parts of the floor is just so exquisite. And that's sort of the bait that you fall with now against the Dallas Mavericks when you have shooters all around the perimeter. Tim Hardaway Jr., yes, he's been in a form slump for the last couple of months, but when he gets hot, he can absolutely stroke it from downtown. Kyrie, of course, has been an elite three-point shooter throughout the course of his career. You have Maxi Kleber, who's a pretty solid three-point shooter. So you just have weapons all around the court. And then it's not just that too, Alex. He can just drive into the lane and then lob it up to Daniel Gafford. Gafford can just set him a pick and just roll to rim, or Derek Lively the second. So I think it's not so they're predicated on one particular play within their offense. They have an assortment of different offensive plays that they can go to, and that's what's hurting teams. And that's why they're, what, 26 and 23 early on? So they've, yeah, what are they now, 49 and 30 or something? So yep, they'll get to 50 wins, and they got to 50 wins right in 2021-22, which was, I think, the first time they got to 50 wins since about their championship year by memory, 2011. So, no, they've just got really clicking at the right time too, and it's, I think it's going to be really dangerous for, most likely be the Clippers matchup anyway for the third time in the last 5 years.
Yeah, three offensive measures I'll throw at you until we move on from the Mavericks. Second in the league at three-point attempt rate. That's the percentage of your total field goals you take as threes. Obviously, Luka can shoot them, but he gets doubled and can throw it around. We talked about to Kyrie, to Maxi, Dante Exum when he's playing, that kind of thing. Tim Hardaway Jr., let's not forget about that. Third in the league in effective field goal percentage. That's your field goal percentage, taking into account the threes are worth more than twos. Second in the league in turnover percentage. So you can really see that they're pushing the pace. They can put up the threes. They love to score, but they do turn the ball over a hell of a lot to let the opposition back in. All right, something else we touched on at the start of the show, I wanted to it was worth mentioning again, Malachi Flynn scoring 50, maybe the most random 50-point game of all time. I'm not sure if you guys are really familiar with Malachi. I am, because I've watched some of those terrible Raptors teams. Got traded, I think, to the Knicks, then to Detroit this year. 18 off 25 off the bench, just... You could have given, like, knowing there's 500 blokes in the NBA, you could have given me 400 choices about who scored 50 before I got to Malachi Flynn. And I only would have got there because I know he was on the Raptors at the start of the season. An absolutely ridiculous performance. I don't know if you guys saw the highlights or even want to comment on this, because it's frankly so ridiculous we shouldn't touch on it, but the floor is open. Should I close the floor? Yeah. It looks like I'm closing the
I
floor.
I think there's one thing, Alex, too. Alex. There's one thing late in regular seasons where teams who go fish in the lottery sort of shut up shop their starters, right? Due to sort of season-ending surgery. And normally just see, as you mentioned too, sort of really unpredictable performances.
But you see guys score 14 points, or maybe if you're lucky, 20. Like 50 to Malachi Flynn was just... sometimes I love the NBA. It's just, I don't know what's happening. And he's not an awful player. He did start the year pretty badly. He had a nice swing before he got traded. Raptors fans fall in and out of love with him all the time. But I just wanted to highlight that. Also, since the last time we spoke, Julius Randle got ruled out for the season. The Bucks have fallen to less than 500 with Doc Rivers. And as we spoke about, Giannis went down. So, Tom, I'll let you pick one of those. And then, Yuri, you can pick up another one.
Look, I'll leave the Bucks for our Bucks man, Yuri. Randall out for the season. That's really going to hurt this Knicks team, especially coming into the postseason. I would love to sit here and tell you that the Knicks will struggle in the first round without Randall because of their playing Team X. But to this moment, we still do not know who they're playing. So for all you know, they end up getting a team that they'll match up fine with and they'll make it out of the first round. But look, looking past the first round, let's say they do get out against whoever they play, I don't think Brunson against one of those bigger teams is going to be able to do it by himself, unfortunately, as well as he has been playing this last couple of months, which, you know, we have to do our awards talk a little bit later in the show. And, you know, you made us write out first, second, third for MVP. And I was very tempted to put Brunson at third because the way he's played this year, you know, you look at how many of his teammates have fallen down. It's ridiculous how he's still being so productive. But no, look, Randall out for the season. It kind of sucks for the Knicks because they had that stretch where they looked so good. But end of the day, who knows? Maybe it might be a blessing in disguise. Maybe someone else steps up. You never know. There's always that one team that goes into the playoffs a bit injured and then out of nowhere, the team performs a bit better, like Tyler Hero last year. So who knows? This might be the Ewing theory all over again in New York.
OG Anunoby did return this week for the Knicks as well. Haven't seen a second of that, but did have 24 points against Chicago today. Yuri, talk to us about the Bucks. We've got Doc Rivers as a shit head coach. I'm going to leave that there. I told you weeks ago this was a mistake and I don't believe in their playoff chances anymore. I'm sticking by it. And then what we know about the Giannis injury.
Yeah, so just to sort of further point on about your elaboration there, Alex, as well on the Bucks, is that Doc Rivers, after the Wizards game, after that absolute disastrous 117-113 loss, blamed the equipment managers, if I'm not mistaken, as well, for 4 minutes and about 51 seconds his post-match presser went for. And I think the biggest phrase to come away from that was, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Well, if we don't know at this stage, Doc, well, I think it's sort
of
going
to
be hanging on tender hooks, mate. But I think the one thing today, having watched the Celtics-Bucks fourth and final meeting of the regular season, is that a lineup change. He went with Pat Beverley to team up with Dame Lillard in the backcourt, and it provides so much more defense, right? That's pretty crystal clear.
I'm going to have to cut in here. Yuri, if you're taking anything from that Celtics game today, I don't know what to tell you because that I'm touching on the Celtics a little bit later. I've never seen the Celtics care less about a game. Even when Jason Tatum was mic'd up going into the game, he literally saying to Derek White pre-game, oh, you know, the next time we're on the road, the game's actually going to matter. We actually have to try, basically, is what he said. So, look, you can say what you want about Pat Bev going at the starting lineup, but today's game, you know, I thought, you know, take as much as you'd like, but honestly, I think the more concerning ones were the games before against the Wizards, the Grizzlies, and the Raptors, and the Knicks.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I'll take that with a grain of salt, but it was somewhat a lineup change that was needed anyway to sort of invigorate and add this whole injection back into the team because, yeah, those four performances, having watched most of them anyway too, were just, they were head-shaking to say the least. I think just pretty despondent after that too. And, of course, Chris suffered that nasty blow to the mouth as well only a game ago as well, which looked pretty bad. And even though he played today and played well too, when Giannis went down with that left calf soleus injuries, the Bucks sort of medical team are calling it. So, yeah, no, just sort of with the Bucks too and sort of how they sort of, yeah, it's just really interesting. That's all with this team too, is there's periods of games where they can defend really well for 3-4 minutes by only giving up a couple of field goals. And there's a 2-3 minute period where they'll just give up a 12-0 run. And those are sort of the areas, especially against Boston, where the Celtics, as Tom knows exceptionally well too, when those threes are falling, it's extremely difficult to contain. And there may be sort of bits and drabs that we'd be able to take away. Maybe not the January 11 matchup, which you guys basically rested your whole starters after halftime too in that blowout win that the Bucks had back at the FISO Forum back in that day too. But yeah, just hopefully it sort of brings about some change. Well, who knows, because we play Orlando twice anyway to finish and our final three games are on the road. So only time will tell, right, whoever we play in the first round series.
That Bucks injury, that Giannis injury, they are calling it a left soleus / calf sprain. Just a reminder for those out there, a sprain is a tear. They haven't yet given it a grading. So the soleus is the muscle underneath the calf muscle. Everyone kind of, gastrocnemius is your top calf muscle. Underneath is the soleus, and the Achilles tendon runs through there as well. So they are calling it a muscle injury, which is positive because at least that's not 12-month recovery. But we shall see. Okay, touching on a couple silly season highlights today. Got shared in our WhatsApp chat. Andre Drummond dunking on a teammate. I'm just going to leave that at that. If you haven't seen that highlight, just pause this podcast. Go on NBA Reddit, go on YouTube, go just type in dunks on teammate. It'll be there. Andre Drummond, shout out. Having a good season off the bench for Chicago. The Suns signed Isaiah Thomas for the rest of the season. Had to be in silly season for that to happen. Aussie Jack White signs a 10-day with the Grizzlies. He's been with the South Bay Lakers in the G League all year after getting moved around and then cut in the offseason after winning a championship with Denver last year. Never forget. And then Tom, you want to talk about the Celtics in silly season.
Yeah, just what they've been doing the last week has just been hilarious because obviously they wrapped up the number one overall seed in the whole entire league the other week when they beat the Thunder. And since then, they have just been taking the mickey out of their opposition. They literally, the other day against Sacramento, you know, every time the lead got up to about 14, they just took their foot off the gas. Sacramento came back and then they're like, okay, let's start playing properly again. Then at the start of the fourth quarter, Joe Mazzulla pulled all the starters, put on the bench. Suddenly a 19-point lead went down to one. Then it went down to a deficit and we were literally down by a point. We'd scored, I think, 3 points in the last 6 minutes. And then Tillman managed to hit a game winner out of nowhere and then we pulled that one out. And I think my highlight of that is going through just Twitter with all the Lakers fans absolutely going tooth and nails against the Celtics because they were fed up. They're like, this is rubbish. They're throwing this game to screw our season up, like yada, yada, yada. It's like I needed another reason to help hate Celtics fans. It's like Lakers fans on Twitter are honestly some of the funniest. And then, you know, today against the Bucks, I was surprised, to be honest with you, that they even bothered sending the team to Milwaukee. And within the first 5 minutes, you could tell, like, the Bucks were sprinting up the floor and the Celtics were jogging. And if you really want to see how much effort they put in, the Celtics were the first team in the history of the NBA today, I think, to not attempt a single free throw in the whole game. Like, they did not even... It was literally just like they dribbled the ball up and went, oh, Giannis and Lopez are in the post. Like, you know what? Let's not go and get injured. Yeah, it's literally it's like, nah, like, let's go just take mid-range shots today in threes and just walk out of here with our ankles and bodies feeling great. And, it, you know, that's why I said before, it's very hard to take much. And it's a shame because the Celtics and the Bucks have played 4 times this year. Once Giannis missed, one was today, one was on, like, the Celtics' fifth game in 7 days or something. We can really only take one matchup into account, and that was at the start of the year, but that was before Doc Rivers came. So if they are to meet in the playoffs, we're going to have zero history on these teams in reality, and it will be a fascinating, you know, build-up to that series. But no, it's just it's fun. I've been enjoying the fact that I'm watching Peyton Pritchard score 20 points a night because I'd much rather this than have to worry about where we're going to end up seeding-wise.
And Yuri, your silly season, you want to talk about the teams at the opposite end of the standings in the lottery.
Yeah, that's always the most compelling part, isn't it, too, Alex?
The most compelling part?
Yeah, most compelling. Well, Spurs, Trailblazers, Pistons, Wizards, who gets the top pick? Because it's all been reported that this year's NBA draft, maybe even the Raptors too, hey, yeah, might get the number one pick. Because this year's draft class, as mentioned, is probably not the strongest from all reports. So that sort of brings about a lot of intrigue on which teams ultimately decide to get that number one pick. But as we, all three of us know anyway too, it's not always a team with the worst record that gets a number one pick, right? Even back to 1997, the Boston Celtics, I think, were 15-67. They were, I think, about 25% probability of securing the number one pick. They ended up getting picks 3 and 6 in that draft. And Tom knows that one well too, because it ended up being Chauncey Billups, as we mentioned earlier in the show, and Ron Mercer, the shooting guard out of Kentucky by memory too, that went with the 6th overall pick that year. So now it'd be sort of really fascinating to see where the ping pong balls drop in, I think it's mid-May, when the lottery is always held. And that's one that's always sort of pretty intriguing because all four teams anyway need that little bit more extra rejuvenation. But who knows about the Spurs, right?
So just as you're talking, go ahead, Tom.
Would it not be the most Wizards thing in the history of ever that they finally, after years of quality draft classes coming through, they finally decide to blow it up. They finally decide to move on Bradley Beal and they get the number one pick where the draft is so far considered pretty average. Like, you know what? You trade for Jordan Poole, you get what you deserve.
That's true. I think the Wizards' last number one pick was John Wall back in 2010.
All this silence is me actually doing the John Wall at my desk. Yeah. For those of you who don't know what that is, you're too young. All right. While you were talking, Yuri, I've just headed over to tankathon.com where we can sim the lottery for the NBA. As a reminder, the rules changed a couple of years ago. So the bottom three teams in the league all share 14% chance of the number one seed. Fourth has 12.5, fifth has 10, and then it steadily goes down until the 14th position, which is right now the Lakers, which would go to the Pelicans. So I'm going to hit Sim Lottery, and the number one pick goes to Charlotte, who had a 52% chance at a top four pick. Portland's jumped three spots. Memphis jumps four spots. Utah jumps four spots. Washington all the way down to sixth. So don't know how. Detroit at fifth too. That's brutal for Detroit. Utah, who've lost 13 in a row. My little sim says they're going to go at the fourth pick in the draft. So well done, Utah. All right, we're going to be back on the other side of the break. Tom, you're not prepared. Throw us to the break.
Well, we don't know how the ping pong balls are going to fall, but I'm fairly confident that the show will be back after the break.
Man, you're getting real good at this. I'm going to have to switch it up on you. All right, we're back from the break. Yuri, a potential first-round matchup between the Thunder and the Pelicans in the 3-6 position. I mentioned it earlier. It's a very attractive first-round season series. Last year, these were the two play-in teams. Talk to us about your thoughts on the 3-6 matchup.
I think it's the difference in size, Alex, with the Pels who have a lot of length, but also the Thunder too. But it's more in the rebounding department where it may be a concern for the Thunder in regards to the Pels. And of course, how much the Pels saw on the offensive glass with Williamson and Valanciunas, who do so much damage on that end, are able to cause. But also the other factor is the Pelicans have got a number of different defenders. Well, apart from CJ McCollum and Zion, who unusually isn't a great defender, they can just stick Herb Jones on Shai Gilgeous-Alexander majority of the time on each of the Thunder possessions and try to really curtail his influence too. So that's one to sort of watch out for too. They've even got Trey Murphy perhaps as well to guard SGA when it's required as well. But I'll be most sort of interested to see as well how much the Pels do decide to go with super small ball, because we've seen probably in the recently as well with them that they've gone with Zion at the five and then played B.I. at the four, even though Ingram's still nursing that bruised left knee injury. So they've really sort of adapted to super small ball and try to really get the floor open in transition too. So that's one to sort of watch out for. And as for the Thunder too, is I think this is probably the big part as well, is with Lu Dort as well. And he's sort of been a real unsung piece as well to the Thunder team for at least the last five, six seasons, and his job and whether he'd guard, say, a Brandon Ingram or perhaps even a CJ McCollum perhaps as well. It's sort of an intriguing storyline to watch out in that regard. And how about even the benches as well? Because the Pels have got pretty good depth on their bench. And whether do they go 9 deep? Do they go 10 deep? Because as we see in the playoffs, right, the bench gets shortened a lot. And some coaches even only go to an 8-man rotation and play their starters 35-plus minutes. And I think when you look at the Pels roster this season, Alex, in terms of minutes played, Coach Willie Green hasn't really dumped a bunch of heavy minutes on his starters. I think B.I. averages about 33 minutes a game. Zion's about 33 as well, or something like that, 32. Valanciunas is about 29. McCollum's is about 33, 34, around that mark. So they don't play sort of significant minutes, but with the playoffs, I think that's sort of what really helps them too, is sort of those fresher legs in that regard as well. Even though the Thunder, likewise too, I think SGA averages about 34.4 minutes per game and the rest is sort of around 29, 30, 31 minutes. But I think it'd just be super intriguing as well, because the Thunder don't take a lot of threes. The Pels sort of, at the start of the season, were sort of just bordering on the bottom five of three-point attempts, and they've sort of altered their game quite a bit as the season's progressed and they've wanting to take up more threes, and they've got pretty good three-point shooters as well at their disposal. B.I., even though we spoke about during the offseason, Alex, in the lead-up to this season, he doesn't take a bunch of threes all that often. But when CJ McCollum shoots about 36% from three-point land, Trey Murphy shoots about 37% from three-point land, they've just got a really wide range of dynamic shooters. And I think their whole versatility as well, switching on the perimeter, definitely is something they may have an advantage on too. But sort of the discussions will come down to if this OKC team is, yes, only SGA and Lu Dort have had playoff experience, right? Gordon Hayward, of course, during his days in Utah. But those two were the last to feature in the playoff series with the OKC Thunder back in 2020 when they lost to Houston Rockets in that first round series in 7 games. And how much does that sort of play a part? Because the Pels haven't made the playoffs. Well, it was only a couple of years ago that they played in the playoffs and stretched the Phoenix Suns to six pretty grueling games, if you want to use that word. So there will be absolutely no fears whatsoever, Alex. And only, I think it was the 2018 playoffs where no one gave them a hope. It was back when Anthony Davis was on the Pels team with Nikola Mirotic and Rajon Rondo and Drew Holiday there that they weren't expected to win the series, but they end up dismantling the Trailblazers in four games. Not going to say that's going to happen this series if this series matchup does eventuate, but I think it's going to be extremely close right throughout.
Tom, I don't know if you want to stay on this series or switch over to the East. We've got Philly and the Heat, the Bucks and Celtics. You choose.
I think Yuri's done a good job of covering all that. I mean, the one question I'll quickly pose is, you know, we saw how much the Thunder struggled with Giannis. We saw how much they struggled with Anthony Davis. Does Zion fall into that category?
Does Jonas Valanciunas fall into that category?
I think the Pels are the best when they go small ball with Zion at the five. So I don't think Valanciunas will be on the floor when it matters, personally. I hope he's not, because I don't know if you saw that Suns Pelicans. I know you definitely didn't see it.
Alex, yeah, I don't watch the Suns.
You watch the Suns, but you know, there was one moment of the game where it was getting close down the stretch, and you know, Durant's gone up to lay it in. He switched to his left, and out of nowhere, Zion just smacked that thing off the board, and it was satisfying. I think watching the ball get absolutely hammered, I thought the glass might break because it was great. But no, look, I'm happy to switch it over to the East because, you know, I think even if Giannis does miss the rest of the regular season, I think the Celtics and the Bucks will be the 1 and 2 seed. And the way things have played out, it kind of feels like Philly and Miami are probably going to be in that 7-8 seed spot. Now, obviously, with the play-in, we still don't know if they will go through. I'll be shocked if Atlanta or Chicago knocks one of them out. But look, my general question is, do the Heat actually stand a chance of beating either of these sides? Because they're the ones that everyone's sort of circling going, oh, we know what happened last year. They beat the Celtics and the Bucks in the playoffs. But the thing is, both these Celtics and Bucks teams are very different from last year when you really look at it. I mean,
different does not mean better.
Different does not mean better. I mean, I can't speak for Milwaukee in that sense, but for the Celtics, it definitely does in this instance. Because really, the reality is, Porzingis is the game changer in this matchup. Because last year, when they threw that zone at us, suddenly it was Robert Williams, who doesn't shoot, Al Horford, who could only really stand in the corner as a very one-dimensional scorer, Jaylen Brown, who's that series definitely not his best, and Tatum, again, not his best either. And then you got Marcus Smart, a rational, confident shooter guy. Whereas this year, we've got guys all around. I mean, pick a player, I'm happy for him to shoot the ball, if I'm being honest with you. But then you put KP in the middle of that zone at the free throw line. Bam Adebayo is a great defender, arguably in the top five for defenders this year. He's not going to be able to stop Porzingis shooting over the top of him because Porzingis is 7'3". So he's going to change that and be the zone breaker for the Celtics. And, you know, this year, Celtics are 3-0 versus the Heat. Bucks are 2-1 versus the Heat. I really don't want to say that the Heat are under threat because I know that will come back to bite me if I do. But I'm not as afraid of them as I was last year. And I'd be interested to know how Yuri feels as a Bucks fan if they are to potentially play Miami again in the first round.
Oh, I'd definitely be scared. That's for sure, Tom. And when the Heat added Terry Rozier, it's that extra offensive punch too, which they sort of desperately need as well too, with Jimmy missing time here and there through injuries and Bam missing only a few games, and he's been pretty durable once more this season, that it sort of does sort of pose a threat too, that Miami is not just dynamic inside as well, where they love to attack the paint, but also in the outside too, even though they don't take many threes, but they nailed them with such efficiency. And that's the real part as well, because the whole structure within the offense and how they're able to run different sets on the play too offensively, which they really seem not to get rattled by it. But then it's defensively too, as you mentioned, Tom, with those 2-3 zones, which Eric Spoelstra loves to throw at every 2 minutes or so when say Miami's down by double digits, or maybe when they're up by 6 or 8 points with about 7 minutes left in the fourth quarter. It's just those unpredictable plays that you don't know what you're going to get from a Miami Heat team, and also just them crashing the offensive boards. And that's the one thing too that they sort of excel at as well, as that rebound, they're able to keep it alive for second chance opportunities. And as we saw last year in the first round series against the Bucks, when Milwaukee had control of game three, and of course it was the Jimmy Butler show when he scored 56 points, and he sort of felt once they got on that run that the momentum just couldn't be stopped at that point. And that's sort of the worry you have with the Miami Heat team as well. And as for Philly, I sort of have the same concerns as well. I just don't know why, but when they've sort of mixed and matched their starting lineup a bit as well, they've had Kyle Lowry pairing up with Tyrese Maxey in the backcourt and sort of freed Maxey so much and not having to sort of assume the ball handling duties as much, and Kyle playing as the facilitator, which he's done for well over a decade. And of course, now you have Embiid returning only a week and a half ago, and he's basically hasn't really lost much of his sort of shape anyway in terms of his whole sort of elite dynamics offensively. And those are sort of my concerns as well with that matchup too, because they did push us pretty hard, Philly, in that first matchup this season as well. And if it hadn't been for Damian Lillard's clutch 39-point performance on debut for the Bucks, well, we probably would have lost that game. So there's just a few facets there which I sort of have concerns as well, being a Bucks fan as well, whether we do play Philly in that 2-7 matchup, if we do finish second in the East, or Miami in the other matchup.
All excellent points there. We haven't yet touched on the Denver and Phoenix possible rematch as well, because this is an interesting one. Denver, obviously, champions last year in the one seed. Phoenix could emerge as the eighth seed in the West. This is really interesting to me. Phoenix, I haven't watched since January 1st. I love that because I don't care about the regular season for them. This is a team that can put it on for a couple games in a row. They've got the big two plus Bradley Beal. They're not a big three. Like, Kevin Durant's a top 12 player of all time. Devin Booker is a stud. They can catch a team like Denver off guard. They took them, what was it, to six last year? Am I misremembering that? To six games? So, look, they're not going to get rolled like the Wolves did or the Lakers did. I think it's a really interesting matchup if everyone's healthy, and I'd be really interested in your thoughts as guys who watch the Suns this year, because God knows I'm not doing that.
I think it could potentially be a close series, but when I say close, I mean for Denver's Dan, it's, again, it could be six games, but I don't think they have an answer for Jokic. I mean, I was lucky enough to be at a Denver-Phoenix game back in December. Murray was out, but also Booker was out and Beal was out as well. So it was literally just Jokic take on Durant. And, you know, it was funny because the Suns fans walked away being like, oh, you know, Jokic, they only just won. You know, Nurkic is the answer to solving Jokic. And I sort of just laughed and was like, sure. I really struggle. If you were to give me the option right now to say, you know, coming out of the West, Denver or the field, I honestly think I would probably pick Denver. They just always have an answer for anything. Like, and I just don't know how anyone's going to beat them in seven games. If it was a 2-3 game series, I could definitely see a team beating them. But seven, like, Jokic is just going to crack you. And on the Suns' perspective, let me tell you, Alex, you're not missing out on a whole lot. I mean, today they were down by about 30-odd points in the first quarter, and it looked like they might not even crack double digits in the first quarter, which is just insane in 2024 standards. They don't shoot enough threes. They don't make enough threes. Durant just has games where you're like, okay, this is the Durant of old. And then he has other games where he's just really passive. And it's like, why should I shoot when I've got Beal and Booker? And it's just like, well, maybe because you're probably the best player still out of the three of them. So if they were to play the Nuggets, I just think the Nuggets schemes would just completely outdo them. I don't think on the defensive end they'd be able to stop Murray or Jokic. And I think it would just not be much of a series for the Suns at least.
In the Western Conference semifinals last year, Nikola Jokic averaged 34.5 points, shooting 60% from the floor and 44% from three, averaged a triple-double, 34, 13, and 10, with two stocks in there. So, look, good luck stopping that, anybody on Phoenix. Yuri, your thoughts?
I think the other concern, too, if this is a potential rematch, is the number of minutes with the Phoenix Suns starting five, and that was a sort of an ongoing trend as that sort of series waned out too, I think, right from game one, where, of course, Kevin Durant and Devin Booker averaged the best part of over 40 minutes a game during the series, and both of them shot poorly from the field too. And that's the same thing what happened in 2022 when KD was in his final playoff series with the Nets in that opening round series against Tom Celtics, and they just completely curtailed him to absolute smithereens. I think Durant shot was about 38% or something in that entire four-game series. And sort of when it comes to that, right, sort of teams can scout for him much better. I think it's just been that sort of thing in playoff series with KD for some particular reason. I think in 2013, we've when Russ went down our opening round series against Houston with that meniscus injury, Memphis just completely stifled him. But in regard to this as well too, with Phoenix, is small ball's not going to work. How long sort of Nurkic is able to stay out of foul trouble, that's going to be a real telling part. And Drew Eubanks, who's the backup center, right, trying to guard Jokic, trying to put double teams on him every time where he can just have, when he has another two eyes in the back of his head for no-look passes. It's just one of those daunting assignments that he can't really devise too many schemes for, and especially against his Denver team where they're so good at sort of moving without the ball as well. They're cutting to the basket and they're sort of slowed down on their number three point attempts too, Alex, but the number threes they take and make is super efficient.
Yeah, this is like the worst matchup possible against Nikola Jokic. So you got Yusuf Nurkic, we talked about, Drew Eubanks as your backup C. Two-way player, Udoka Azubuki, the third-year bloke out of Kansas. I think he's from Nigeria. Kevin Durant bloody plays the C for them. They got Bol Bol, David Roddy, both young guys. Then Thad Young is your veteran, 16 years in the league. And as someone who watched Thad Young play recently, good luck. You might get him for two quarters, and that bloke is going to need a month recovery. So I don't know. I mean, Devin Booker shot like 56% from three last series. They crossed six games, if I remember correctly. Like, there's hot shooting potential in this series. I'm just saying, let's keep an eye on it. Let's pin it for later. All right. I think we'll move on to our NBA awards for the year. I've asked you guys to pick a top three in each of the following categories: MVP, the rookie, the coach, the most improved, the sixth man, the defensive player of the year, and the clutch. I don't know if you guys figured out the clutch stuff, because it should just be tied to stats, let's be real. But Tom, I haven't heard your voice in a minute, so let's roll with you. MVP, working backwards from three.
So third, I went SGA. He sort of tailed off the last couple months. He still had an incredible season. You know, he scores 30 pretty much every night. But, you know, I just had to put him third because the next guy, Luka, who again, if you'd asked me about a month and a half ago, I would have said no way because they were flirting with the play-in. Now that they're a five seed, you kind of have to look at his stats and go, he's had an incredible season. He deserves to be in the two spot. But one, you have to go Jokic. 26.4 points per game, 12.4 rebounds, 9 assists per game. So he's nearly averaged triple-double. He's played 76 games. He's shooting 57.8% from the field. The crazy stat when I was looking up this season stats is overall he's a plus 660. Like that's insane. And he's only averaging 34.6 minutes per game. But you know, to put up those stats in only playing that amount, it's no wonder why he's a playoff riser, because he just plays more minutes. So of course he's going to get more stats. And the Nuggets overall 55-24 in what has been a very difficult Western Conference. I'm just, you know, I'll never not be amazed by the stuff he does, and I can't wait to watch him in the playoffs again, provided that he doesn't end up going up against my team.
All right, so Tom, Jokic in the number one spot. Yuri, backwards from three.
So I initially didn't have a number three, but I'll probably stick with Brunson for number three.
Yeah,
just with the scoring, I think, especially since Randle went down in late January in that game against the Miami Heat, and OG Anunoby, who, of course, had just recently returned from that elbow injury, but Jalen's had to take up a bunch of the scoring, right? And we saw today in the game against the Chicago Bulls, scored, what, 45 points. There was another game against the Bucks recently, scored over 40 points, and he's consistently able to just produce and produce and produce. And sort of his whole repertoire of different offensive moves as well, too, he can slow him down, but he hardly gets curtailed. And that's the big thing as well. And even at his size, he's just able to sort of smoothly navigate his way through the court. And to see him now, what average was it, 28.2 points per game? He's shooting a super efficient 47% as well from the floor too. And I think he's, what, 84% from downtown. And he's averaging, I think, in minutes played, he's about 35.1 or 35.2, which is quite a fair number too. He's averaging about 6.6 assists. So he's pretty much doing everything on the floor and keeping the Knicks absolutely, well, not rolling, I'd say, but just keeping them steady on the ship.
They're a very good team.
Navigated their way through. So definitely having number three there. I think number two, well, number one out SGA, number two out Luka Doncic as well. Just, I think, may have timed it just a bit too late, even though he's had another triple-double today as well, the 77th of his career. But I think when you look throughout the whole season and OKC from where they've started as well in terms of a win-loss record and Shai's production, that's where I think Shai probably gets the chocolates in that aspect too, with OKC basically being well over 10 games above 500 right from the early outset of the season and then being 54-25. And yes, he sort of had just a little bit of a dip with his scoring. I think it was about 31.5 points and sort of dropped down to about 30.2 or 30.3. But his whole field goal efficiency is just, it's stupendous for a shooting guard, Alex, to be shooting, what, 52-53% from the floor. Yes, his three-point shot isn't probably elite, even though he shoots about 35-36%, which is
he's starting solid. To take more of them, yeah.
Yeah. Yep, and that's the big part too. And I think his whole clutch plays, right? We saw against the Kings, he took over when the Thunder needed him late. He scored 40 points as well. But yeah, I think just right from the outset, his consistency, I think that's what takes him over the line as well. And of course, Jokic has won those two MVPs anyway.
I've had SGA as my number two at least all season until Embiid went down. I had him number one for the majority of the season. I've left him at one. I don't feel great about it, and I'm not sure. I think I'm going to leave him at one, but Giannis and Jokic are both right behind him at two. Jokic, we've talked about at length. Giannis, I had the stats up in front of me before, is having a better season than last year, is having a better season statistically across the counting stats and in every shooting percentage than his second MVP season. Just ridiculous stuff. I think he's upped his efficiency from 55% from the floor to 60%. Every counting stat is better except rebounds has dipped very slightly. Giannis was on a tear, no pun intended, up until today. And I don't think Milwaukee... Actually, it's probably the worst thing possible for Milwaukee he does get injured today because that means you're going to get bumped in the first round. Sorry, Yuri, which means you can't blame the coach because Giannis was injured, so you keep Doc Rivers for next year. All right, so I had Luka in third as well. Luka sneaks in, and honestly, yeah, Luka's so fun to play. Rookie of the year, Tom. Count backwards from three.
So I went Brandon Miller. I mean, someone had to be third. He's had a solid season. He's been really good the last couple of weeks with Charlotte, though. I mean, again, it's a two-horse race, always has been. Second, I've got Chet. He was probably first for the first 3 months of the season, and then Wemby went, oh, hey, I'm actually amazing at this basketball game, and showed us what he's really capable of. You know, it's funny because he could have come into the league and probably produced about 80% of what he's done and he'd still go, okay, the signs are there. The fact that he's done what he's done and he's lived up, not only lived up, he's exceeded expectations for someone who's probably had the highest expectations ever as a number one pick is just insane. And, look, I'm intrigued by what you've written down in the doc.
There, hey, Alex, don't spoil it. Don't spoil it.
I'm not spoiling it, but for me, I've got Wemby first and just by a landslide.
Yuri, your rookies of the year, backwards from three.
So I had third Jaime Jaquez Jr., the Miami Heat. I think just right good. Throughout this season too. Yep, he's not just his production, but I think his whole maturity for a guy who played his full 4 years at UCLA too, and he definitely won the trust quickly of Coach Eric Spoelstra, finished games off late, and he just fits perfectly in the Miami Heat culture. He cuts extremely well. He makes the right reads, and it was just a real, I think, a match made perfect for the Heat as well, taking pick 18 overall when other teams had the opportunity to draft him. Second, well, it was sort of a way up, right, as Tom mentioned too, during those first couple of months of the season. Chet has to be number two. I think just because the even balance that OKC's had with him, Jalen Williams, SGA there too, sharing the load. Of course, SGA's averaging over 30 points a game. But sort of that even contribution within that whole Thunder team is probably the reason why Chet falls in at number two. And then, of course, number one being Victor Wembanyama. And we saw right early in the season how he probably shot selection probably was sort of iffy at the best of times too, where he'd pull up for threes where probably they weren't there. And his field goal percentage was down to about 42% early on. He was averaging about 17.5 points. But his numbers since then, Alex, they've just bumped up to, what, 21.2 points per game and about 10.7 rebounds or something. And he's averaging, what, 3.7 blocks, which is just incredibly astounding, right, for a rookie in his first year, even though we knew already about his high, lofty expectations heading into the season and how much he's done to carry the team.
Okay, so hear me out, all right? This is my rookie picks. Brandon Miller at third. He's looked good a lot of the times I watched Charlotte play early in the year too. I had Chet as rookie of the year, and I've got stats to back up my position. I'm open to changing it. It's in pencil. If you told, I would tell you right now, my position is of Wemby is not to spoil defensive player of the year. I picked Wemby for the defensive player of the year. I think Wemby has a chance to be the best player of all time. I don't think that's true of Chet. I think Wemby is likely going to be the best player in this rookie class. I don't think that that's going to be Chet. And I think next year, Wembanyama is probably going to be the better player. But I've watched a lot of Oklahoma City and I've watched a lot of San Antonio Spurs this year. And I've got some stats that kind of reflect watching those two teams. Chet Holmgren in his rookie season has played every single game. He's played 79 games. Victor Wembanyama's played 70. That's not a knock on him. That's still way more than we expected. Victor Wembanyama, 21.5 points. Chet scores 16.5. Rebounds, Chet's losing 8 to 10. Field goal percentage. Victor Wembanyama at 7'4", 47% field goal percentage. Chet Holmgren at 7'1", 53% field goal percentage. The three-point shooting. Chet started a little bit hotter, but it fell down to 37%. While Victor Wembanyama, that shot selection is still a big issue for him, 32%. He's starting to improve the catch-and-shoot threes, I think. I don't have that stat in front of me. I think it's the catch-and-shoot threes he's improved on, but the pull-ups aren't as good. Win shares, the advanced metrics, a flawed stat because it depends on how good the team is doing, but Victor Wembanyama, 3.3 win shares compared to 8.1 for Chet. He does pull down less blocks than Wemby. Wemby gets 3.5. That leads the league. I think Chet's second in the league with 2.4. True shooting percent, Chet was 63 over Wemby's 56. Usage percentage, it goes through Chet 32% of the time compared to 21% from Wemby. And the defensive and offensive win shares paint a picture. Defensive win shares, Chet at 4, Wemby at 4.5 or 4.3. Offensive win shares, Chet at 4, Wemby at -1. Now, what that does in my mind, and this kind of paints a picture with the games I've watched, is Chet is part of, at times, what has been the best offense in the league. The Oklahoma City Thunder have won 54 games. They've got, I think, the MVP in the league, but a top five MVP player in SGA. He's also benefited from second-year Jalen Williams just becoming an absolute superstar. So let's make no bones about it. He's surrounded in a really good team, really good coaching. I think the maturity, the shot selection, the defensive effort might be higher than Victor Wembanyama, and he's been available every game. I think they have been comparable for most of the year, although, Wemby might be the better player. It's just unfortunate he's been on a really poor team. It's also unfortunate that offensive game isn't as quite as developed as we had. We did think the offense might be an issue coming into the season. I can be talked out of this position, Tom. I know you've been a little bit hesitant. What do you say to me picking Chet?
No, look, it's a fair pick, but I think if you would just solely look at the last 2-3 months of the season, Wemby has been far and away much better. I mean, OKC played my Celtics the other night with no SJ or Jalen Williams, and it was Chet's time to step up, and there were times that I just generally forgot he was on the floor. Whereas with Wemby, you don't ever not see him out there. The stuff he's been doing is just things that we've never seen anyone do. And look, obviously his body type is an advantage in some of those areas, but still, Chet has been able to sit back as a third sort of star on that team. Whereas Wemby, if you look at most of the Spurs wins, the times he's played and they've won, he's been the sole reason for it. And that's just why. And also, look, rookie of the year winning, I don't know how much you should weigh into it because, we saw that one in 2017 when Simmons, Donovan Mitchell, and Tatum were the three candidates. And it was sort of like, they all got drafted to good teams that were ready to compete. Whereas this year, two out of the three of the finalists that you and I have chosen, Alex, didn't even finish in the playoffs. So for me, I just take winning out of it and had to go for Wemby.
And a lot of Wemby's defensive efforts don't show up in the box score. You see three guys on a 3-on-1 break and they all just kind of pussy out and go, I'm not going anywhere near that guy. Look, I think I'm sticking with Chet, but I really did think about Wemby recently. He's probably already the better player, but a season as a whole, I think Chet come out of the gate a lot stronger and maintained. Not maybe through the whole season, like Wemby's been playing great, but I'm probably wrong. I'll pick Chet. All right, Coach of the Year, Yuri.
So from number 3, Jamal Mosley, the Orlando Magic, and their season turnaround too, as well from last season, should I say, having won what 35 games? They were 5-25, 5-20 earlier last season, but this season, why are they 46-33? And it's, yeah, just been an incredible turnaround for a team as well. That's just been slowly building into becoming one of the best young teams in the league, and on the defensive principles as well that he's brought as well. Jalen Suggs and Jonathan Isaac, since his return right from all those knee injuries, just been an incredible force on that end. So got the Magic finishing, well, got Jamal Mosley finishing third in coach of the year. Second, we've got Mark Daigneault of the OKC Thunder too, 54-25 record. They were, what, 40-42 last season. And he's just done another terrific job, should I say, as well, of the X's and O's with the team as well, and just drawing up a bunch of really good offensive sets too. And he, yeah, really just seems to lose his cool too much as well, Mark Daigneault. And I think his whole sort of youthful enthusiasm to the team's definitely sort of translated to, and the players know exactly what they have to execute on both sides of the floor. And number one, I said this before the start of the season as well, in another sort of article prediction, Chris Finch for coach of the year. I think what he's been able to do once again as well, Minnesota's defense was sort of middle tier last season. They couldn't get the sort of the chemistry they wanted going with Towns and Gobert, of course, with Towns' four-month calf injury, and sort of having to integrate them back this season. Maybe there were questions too, how long that would take, but right from the outset, though, that big, tall trio is just absolutely, Jewish, I say, is absolutely taking another leaf out of whatever book they've had in terms of a dynamic front court in Minnesota Timberwolves history. And Chris Finch is a big part of that. Why? And two, as well, with just his sort of defensive philosophies as well, what he's brought to the team. And it's a reason why they're sitting 55-24 and perhaps as well three more wins to equal their best ever win-loss record in franchise history, 58-24.
Tom, we're starting to run out of time, but number three for you, you had Mark Daigneault. Chris Finch for number two. Who was your number one?
I went for Adrian Griffin. He only lost 13 games all year. You know, that's really, really hard to do. No, of course not. Look, it's my one bias pick. I went for Joe Mazzulla. And let me just lay out the case for you. Let me just lay out the case for you. You know, look, they traded out Smart, Rob Williams, Brogdon, let go of Grant Williams. That's four of their top six rotation last year. Holiday got traded in. He went from being a number two option on a number one seed to a number five option. Porzingis got brought in. He went from being sort of a 1-2 option in the Wizards to a 3 option. Tatum and Brown both had to take steps back for the betterment of the team. Horford went to the bench. They've had the best record all season. And from the get-go, they've looked like the best team in the regular season all season long, except for those two games against Denver. To do that as a coach is impressive. To do that as a second-year coach who has basically walked out the door nearly last year's in the postseason is pretty hard to do. And the reality is it's never easy to bring in all these new stars and integrate them at once. Even Miami struggled and they had LeBron, but he's done it well and they've won over 60 games and they've had a very comfortable season. So that's my case. But quickly, I know neither of you guys are big Twitter people, so I have some breaking news for you.
Uh-oh.
Bucks' Giannis Antetokounmpo has avoided damage to his left Achilles tendon, a best-case outcome, and his return to play is based on treatment and rehab responses for strained calf, league sources tell Shams.
Okay, positive news. So if it's going to be grade one strain, we might see him in round one. If it's a grade two strain, round one starts in less than 2 weeks, I don't think we see him in round one. If it's a grade three strain, we might not see him at all for the rest of the season. So fingers crossed we get a good grading coming out of it and he's avoided major injury. Yuri was praying to the gods during that whole segment. All right, my coach of the year, I had Joe Mazzulla second. I felt so dirty about that, but I'm glad to see somebody else thought he did the right job. Jamal Mosley in third and Mark Daigneault in the top spot. For most improved, I didn't have a second or third, although I was a bit disappointed Tyrese Halliburton's injury lingered because I thought he was a real candidate before the hamstring injury. I had Coby White going from 9 points per game off the bench to 19 for Chicago. He's been pretty good. I know, Tom, you had Tyrese Maxey with Coby White behind him. And then, Yuri, you had Coby White in the number spot and Jonathan Kuminga in number two. Is that right?
Yeah, I did. I think just from January onwards, right, where he made that public sort of announcement away too that he wanted more playing time and Steve Kerr rewarded him. And we saw, right, with that matchup with him and Wiggins pairing together, and a lot of people talk about, well, they can't really coexist because they sort of have the same similar sort of games, but they found a way, right? And he's sort of been the one that's really flourished as the season's worn on, and I think deservingly so too.
We all had the same top two for Sixth Man of the Year. Tom and Yuri, you both had Malik Monk from the Sacramento Kings. Then Naz Reid, I had the order reversed. Naz Reid shooting 42% from three, 13 points, five off the bench. I had him number one. Just quickly, did anybody really give any thought to the Clutch Man of the Year? I'm getting a shake from Tom. Yuri's not saying much. I think we all had DeRozan, if I scroll quickly enough. That should just be a stat award. You should just get it based on the stat. And then Defensive Player of the Year. I mentioned I had Victor Wembanyama first. Tom, what did yours look like?
I just went for Gobert, just simply because, the Timberwolves right now are the one seed. They could very well finish with the one seed. He's a big reason why. And also, let's be real. Let him have this one, because Wemby's winning probably the next 10. Just let him have the last one. Just like Wemby's winning the next 10. Barring injury, Wemby's winning the next 10. So just like Gobert, let him have one and then, move on. And just a quick sub note. My God, how is anyone going to score on France in the Olympics? I can't wait.
Yeah.
Like, I've never been this excited for an Olympics ever.
And they don't even have Embiid anymore. Like, imagine if they had Wemby at the four, Embiid at the five, Gobert. I don't know what you do with Gobert as the sixth man off the bench. I got no clue. Yuri, your defensive player of the year.
Yeah, I just only had one, and that was Rudy Gobert. I think that's pretty obvious and has been from early doors this season as well, that he's back to his best. And of course, already spoke about too, that last season was sort of a bit of an acclimating year for him, but he sort of found that sort of, not spark, if you want to use that term, but he sort of found that real reinvigoration within the on the defensive end too, shall I say, and just absolutely bullied teams as well in the paint as well, with shot blocking and just rebounding, pulling down boards 15, 20 a game. And well, his rebounding numbers are about 12.9 points per game, which is exceptional, which is, of course, around his career average anyway, 10, 11 rebounds per game right throughout. But no, it's pretty obvious that no one else sort of stacks up to where Gobert is for this season.
Just quickly shout out our Julian Balthazar picked Rudy Gobert for Defensive Player of the Year at $18 odds when everyone else wrote him off. All right, we're running out of time. We've got like 30 seconds to get through Performance of the Week. Tom, yours is.
Brunson versus the Bucks, 43 points, 8 assists, 6 rebounds, win. That's all I need to
Yuri,
say.
you had.
Paul George's 39 points in the 26-point comeback over the Cavaliers, and I was able to watch that final quarter. That was just one spectacle from PG, right? Where he hit big shot after big shot in the fourth as well. 23 of those points, I'm pretty sure, came in the final 12 minutes. That big shot as well over Evan Mobley as well, where he sent him flying to the floor. And then that big clutch shot, clutch block shot, say, as well, and Darius Garland on essentially the game's final possession. So he did it all right, Alex. And another much-needed win for the Clippers to basically seal up the fourth spot out west.
I had Malachi Flynn's 50 burger. Come on, you know I love when guys who don't play much get big scores, and that's the biggest one that we might ever see. That's it for the 51st episode of the NBA show here on the Mojo Sports Network. We're really running out of time and trying to get the outro in quickly as possible. That's been Tom Dev. That's been Yuri Bilsic. I've been Alexander J. We'll see you maybe next Wednesday. We haven't decided. Next episode will be either during or directly after the play-in tournament. We haven't figured that one out. But stay tuned here on the Mojo Sports Network. This has been today's show. Goodbye. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers, Alex.